see if I can hold it up here, if that works. This is nice, I wish I was teaching. Thank you, Howard, for the lovely introduction, and thanks everyone for coming. It's my first time being Sabre, and I'm having a great time so far. We've only just started. So, as Howard just mentioned, you know, Taiwan, many people are familiar with Taiwan's rampant success, really, in the Little League World Series. They're currently in a drought by their high standards. I don't think there's been a team that's won from Taiwan since 1996, but between 69 and 96, they won about 17 titles. In fact, they won in 1969, which was the first year that a Taiwanese team entered, and they won 9 of the following 12 titles in the Little League World Series baseball. So, when I first became attracted to Taiwanese baseball as a subject as a whole, this was naturally something that kind of leaped out at me, that was of note. And I particularly, as an historian, became interested, well, where did this come from? Where did this amazing baseball heritage come from? And having lived in Taiwan myself, youth baseball continues to be kind of one of the central elements of the baseball experience in Taiwan. The 500 New Taiwan dollar note on one side has these young victorious little leaguers reaching to the skies, and you meet people who know about these various little league teams. But also as a historian, you know, historian is such a broad word. I belong to a subset of historians who tend to sit around and talk to each other and go to conferences with much fewer people than this, and generally write books that nobody will ever read. And so, and we're obsessed with mechanisms and processes and things like that. In Taiwan's history in the 20th century, they were a colony until the end of World War II. They were a colony of Japan. And following that, they were not a free society. Free democracy really only takes root in Taiwan. It liberalizes in the 1980s, and in the early 1990s, you begin to have direct presidential votes and the like. And so for most of the 20th century in Taiwan, you generally have two groups of people, those with more power, or a lot of power, and those who are being exploited or being subjected to this power. And sport historians, and especially looking at colonial situations like Taiwan, we tend to kind of think about either one or both of two conditions happening. That the sport is being used by the more powerful people as propaganda or what have you, or to try and make the lesser powerful people more like us or easier to control. Or the sport is being used by those with less power to kind of strike back or to associate with each other, become a kind of nationalist kind of outfit. And that is very true actually in Taiwan in the 1970s in particular. That was a time when you first had people really starting to talk about ideas of what it means to be Taiwanese, not just Chinese, which in a Cold War context was very threatening to the people running the country of Taiwan, or running Taiwan at that time. And you had fans in Pennsylvania holding up banners and signs in the hope it would be seen on television cameras and seen at home. And there were really some scraps between kind of rival fans of different political factions and things like that. It was very, very politicized indeed. But before that, Taiwan is actually a complete exception to this idea that sports are inherently political in situations like this. In 1895, Japan defeated China in the first in a Japanese war, and unfortunately for the Chinese, it wasn't even close. It was a pretty vicious victory on the side of the Japanese. And what had really given the Japanese, and the spoils of that particular war, among other things, was that Taiwan, you know, a very small island, really the kind of wild west frontier of China at that time, known for producing sugar and horrible diseases and little else, was handed over to Japan as Japan's first colony, thus began kind of Japanese imperial dreams and the like. But what had really given the Japanese a serious edge in that war was that they had, mostly with the adoption of Western style and modern kind of ideas, had completely overhauled their government. They had completely overhauled their military, which was one of the things that made them very powerful indeed against the Chinese in that war. And they overhauled their education system. And when Taiwan became a part of the Japanese community or the Japanese imperial society, that education system came to Taiwan also. Big change for the people who'd been living as Chinese communities for hundreds of years to that point was the introduction of physical education, you know, gym class and things like this. And up here I've got some pictures of a kind of general calisthenics and jumping around in uniform, martial arts here in the bottom left, and the right we have a this expansive field, this kind of track and field type arena. And this was a big change for the people already living in Taiwan, the non-Japanese, because in Chinese culture up to that point, to be active, to be out and sweating and growing your muscles was really not a done thing at all. You were much happier telling your friends, well, my son is inside reading, thank you very much. He's learning all about the appropriate Confucian ways to write poetry, etc., etc. The Japanese now have taken on some Western ideas of people becoming healthier and stronger, and this makes our country healthier, makes our country stronger. And although they by no means treated the Taiwanese as level partners in this, equal partners, they did bring this idea to Taiwan. But they didn't bring baseball as part of that. Now, baseball is still only growing in popularity. It arrived in Japan towards the end of the 1800s. But nevertheless, it is popular, and it's becoming popular in Japanese schools. But they make very little effort at all to make it a part of people's school lives. And so although you have to do the calisthenics, the martial arts, what have you, you're not playing baseball. Baseball arrives in Taiwan with young professionals. Young men mostly working for the sugar company, which is a big industry, the railroad company, the post office, etc., etc. And one of the criteria, one of the categories of professionals who brought the game were teachers and young men trained to be teachers. And so that was actually the first time you start to see baseball turn up in schools in Taiwan. These young men up here at the top right-hand corner, they're actually all students in a rare example in the 1910s of a game that was between a team entirely composed of students and another team entirely composed of students. Occasionally students jump in, but mostly with their teachers. Another interesting thing is that today, up to this point, up to the very end of the 1910s, all of these people are Japanese. They're not people who were living there before 1895. Our first recorded example of any Taiwanese person playing an organized game of baseball is in 1919. So in the 1920s, things changed very drastically. There's a number of reasons, one of which is government policy from Tokyo. Up until about 1919-1921, the Japanese are kind of keeping the Taiwanese at arm's length a little bit. They call it coexistence as opposed to kind of integration. And in the early 1920s, the Japanese decide they want to try, at least the Japanese in Tokyo decide, they want people to start interacting more and going to school together more and things like that in Taiwan. And that's when you start to see baseball turn up and see Taiwanese people play baseball. But another big thing, another way in which it became important in the consciousness of the society as a whole, was the huge popularity of baseball tours at this time. At the bottom here, I have Waseda University. Waseda University is later one of the big six of the Japanese universities. They made baseball and international baseball tours a big part of their identity. They were playing against Stanford more than a decade before this. They went as far inland as Chicago in 1911. And so they kind of had a track record of traveling the world and playing baseball. Obviously, visiting Taiwan was a bit different from visiting the US, with Taiwan being a colonial possession. But they kind of pioneered this idea of teams coming to Taiwan to play the slowly growing amateur organizations that are developing there. In 1917, Waseda University first visits, and it's a really kind of a low-key affair. It's not exactly an alumni kind of event, but it pretty much is for Japanese people living in Taiwan. But by the mid to late 1920s, it's just a huge event every time it happens. And the hunger for information on the growing university scene in Japanese baseball is justified in the newspapers here. It's growing an audience of more than just Japanese colonials. And later in the 20s, we have teams like Mainichi Shimbun, which is literally the daily news, a very large publication group, who start sending teams over to play in exhibitions. These very dapper gentlemen here with their wreath and arriving in Taipei. And one of the most prominent visits is that of Herbert Harris Hunter's Barnstormers, very, very early in 1921. This started out as a trip to Japan, and in Japan there was a falling out over money of some descriptions. I'm sure it was a frequent problem with things like this. Mr. Hunter kind of took the remnants of his squad and arrived in Taiwan and caused an absolutely, huge amount of interest. You see here, there's a picture, I'm sorry about the quality, of a young local batter probably Japanese, but maybe Taiwanese, who's had to climb a massive, massive, impossibly large stepladder to try and face this titanic, enormous Caucasian picture in front of them. And on the far right, we have a little graphic that was meant to inform readers on who these guys were, because they're doing a lot of the typical barnstorming stuff, mucking around in the outfield, doing silly things and trying to attract the crowd. And so beside this picture in the original Japanese, there's some kind of index to give you an idea of who these guys were. And it was very, very influential. It brought the idea of barnstorming in some small way into the Taiwanese experience. And that's really where we see the emergence of the first kind of Taiwanese team. In fact, these young men are all Aboriginal Taiwanese. There are three ethnic groups in Taiwan at this time. You have the Japanese, who arrived in 1895. You have the Chinese Taiwanese, who've been living there since the 1600s. And you have the Aboriginal Taiwanese, as they're known. And they're basically, they were there for as long as people were there. They're more ethnically similar to Malaysians and Filipinos, for example, than they are to the Chinese and the Japanese. And the Chinese and Japanese, unfortunately, does have an exceptionally racist view of the Aboriginal Taiwanese, which does, though, translate into an interesting role for this group in Taiwanese baseball. In 1921, a young man walking through kind of the countryside surrounding the Taiwanese city of Hua Yen on the east coast sees a group of young Aboriginal Taiwanese, and according to him, and this account is still faithfully reported in Taiwanese histories, saw a bunch of Aboriginal Taiwanese running around, sweating, throwing rocks at each other, and swinging sticks. And he has this epiphany: "Eureka! I will make them baseball players. It would be wonderful, and I will civilize them and make them citizens." And instead, Brett, he starts talking about, "Think of all the money I could make with my Aboriginal Taiwanese barnstormers." And that's exactly what they turned out to be. In 1923, they toured Japan, and 2 years later, they toured Japan. The tour of Japan, particularly in 1925, is very important because it's the first time you see a team of note traveling the other way. Since the late 1910s, there are teams coming from Japan to Taiwan regularly, all the time. And, it's very much, look at us, the guys from the Big Brother is sending his best ball, or some ball players to meet us. The Nungao team, as they're called, is a Chinese name. The Japanese call them Team Nobo, N-O-K-O. They're actually quite good. They won four and drew four, or sorry, they won four and lost four in Japan, so they managed to save some element of face. But they never got away from this kind of novelty of their ethnic identity, their ethnic background. And it's kind of interesting because it was exactly the same thing in Taiwan 2 years earlier. They were discussed in the newspapers almost in exactly the same way that the Mainichi Shimbun were discussed, or that the visiting university teams were discussed. Although not quite as tabloid style, almost the same record that Mr. Hunter's team was discussed. They were like a foreign visiting team almost. And the city they lived in, which is only about 100 miles, not very far at all from the colonial capital, is like the frontier with all these alien peoples in there. So, there's been some kind of attempt to talk about Nungao as the first true Taiwanese team and talk about the political validity of baseball in that sense, but unfortunately they really were kind of a novelty, and the team fades away very, very quickly and don't leave much of a legacy behind them. That's not quite true of Kano, the Kano team that came from the Jiayi Forestry Agricultural College. The Japanese called them Kano. And they were a true multi-ethnic team. Their starting lineup, but it wasn't just kind of an overall squad, but the lineup was mostly Japanese, mostly one group. Their starting lineup was almost equally divided between Chinese Taiwanese, Aboriginal Taiwanese, and Japanese people. And these high schoolers became quite prominent in Taiwan in the very beginning of the 1930s. And they did something that nobody in Taiwan had done at that point. They went to the Koshien tournament in Japan, which was the national high school tournament, which had begun in the late 1910s and which had mid 1910s. And it was already at this point an extremely, extremely popular sporting event in Japan. Today in Japan, it remains an extremely popular sporting event. A couple of years earlier, the Taiwanese baseball kind of associations and authorities had successfully gain entry into this contest. They could start sending the winners of their little tournaments. They could start developing to Kaohsiung to compete. And they were always, you know, ruthlessly beaten. Essentially, the standard was much, much higher in Japan. But in 1931, the Kano team went there and got all the way to the final. And this was a big, big deal. And, you know, they're really a fascinating team to read about and to read, you know, conclusions about them. There's no question that at that time, the Kano team, that year especially, 1931, the Kano team were very much described as, look how victorious our colonial project has been. Look how harmonious society in Taiwan is. And there's no question there's a heavy ideological analysis of the team in Japan happening at that time. They're presented in a way to celebrate this kind of harmony. But the Kano team also are very interesting because, you know, as I go through the sources and the newspapers myself, in the years that follow, by about 1930, well, before that, certainly by 1935, the Kano team name persists almost as a brand or as a team name, but this idea of the multi-ethnic composition is gone. They're almost entirely Japanese athletes at that point. It doesn't persist. There's no effort put on to kind of keep Kano going with some kind of a propaganda enterprise at all. In fact, I do argue that this Kano finalist, that was a victory for the Taiwanese baseball community rather than some concept of a Taiwanese nationalist idea. This was an achievement for them, and it was held up in that sense. So that's why the Kano team, for me, are a fascinating team. Now, jump forward, it's a problem covering a long period of time, to the Maple Leaf team, also the Hongyan Maple Leaf team in 1968. These are the guys, these are the boys who opened the door to Little League World Baseball for Taiwanese, for junior Taiwanese athletes. In 1945, Taiwan passes back to Chinese control at the end of World War II. And in 1949, after the communist victory in the mainland, the Republic of China government, the nationalists, retreat to Taiwan to stop this government in exile. And they hate everything Japanese. The Japanese invaded China in 1937. The Japanese had no small role in the victory of the communists in China in the 1940s by severely weakening the nationalist forces. And they arrived, they're very famous for arriving in Taiwan and hearing fragments of the local Chinese dialect, Taiwanese, which had borrowed some words from Japanese. And they got very concerned about this and brought in an extremely strict language policy, and especially in schools with young children. But anyone in public was expected to speak in perfect standard Chinese or accent, anything like that. But they left baseball alone. And for me, I think there's two reasons. One, I honestly don't think they saw it as a political threat. Two, there's no question that the growing relationship between the United States and Taiwan is a factor. You have more and more American servicemen in Taiwan in the 1950s. The last thing you want to do is start stomping all over the national past, the American pastime. But in 68, this team, baseball persists, teams are still meeting to play each other, and in 1968, this Hongye team, this team of Aboriginal Taiwanese, again, from the southeast of Taiwan, one of the poorest parts of the island, rise up and become a kind of a super team, beating everybody around them. And finally, you know, the more powerful people, the government in this case, take it over and leap on the chance to make them, you know, standard bearers for these political ideas. And they get talked about as having this capitalist spirit. They have to pay for themselves to get paid for these games an awful lot, for example. And they're very represented as kind of go-getters, very, very, very non-communist. And in 1968, they defeat a team from Wakayama, Japan. And Wakayama was the home of the reigning Little League World Series champions at that time. The only catch is the boys at the home of the Maple Leaf team beat were not the same boys, but they decided to kind of gloss over that and was just like, yeah, we beat the world champions, it's okay. And so they start to see the potential for the sport in that political sense. And that's, you know, I covered a lot of time here in 20 minutes, but that's what I personally find interesting, because this idea of these mechanics of sport conveying propaganda or conveying nationalism, they're really useful and they're often true, and they're always helpful. But what I like about the Taiwanese experience is that it is the exception. It doesn't conform to that quite so easily. Yes, it does eventually. But up until the 1960s, we can see that you can't just consider baseball in Taiwan to be some kind of, you know, inferior version or a different version of what's happening in America or even what's happening in Japan. It's its own thing. And just being here at Sabre and exchanging oral histories and hearing all, I've been a baseball fan for not all my life, so you've all got the lead on me. And it's an important part of the experience. That's how baseball in America works. In Taiwan, they have a different experience, and I think that's an interesting thing, not just for baseball, but for all sports, but certainly when researching baseball outside the United States. So thank you very much for being so kind.
Do we have any questions for John?
So I have, and I don't know if this is just propaganda or what, but I have heard that part of their success in the Little League is because they calculate ages differently.
Not that I go into that exactly, but that happens a lot in the 70s. To be honest, it's not some kind of honest mistake. There was some strange gray area stuff going on. University of Nebraska Press, actually, who are here as vendors, they published a book a few years ago called Playing in Isolation, where the author, Jim Lemieux, talks about that a lot. There was some very strange, possibly loose usage of birthdays and things. The bigger issue, actually, was that they tended to make super teams, and so they tended to kind of recruit really good athletes from just outside school districts. So, yeah, that's kind of, as Dr. Yu in his book, he talks about that as a big shame for Taiwanese history, so that's an interesting book to look out for the cast.
Okay, more questions?